supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. We're starting with this late news. There is no train service through Center City Philadelphia stations until further notice. Again, no train service through Philadelphia Center City stations until further notice due to an emergency evacuation. More on this development as news comes in during this evening. 1 week after Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico, the island remains without power, and that's left many of its more than 3 million residents unable to communicate with loved ones. That includes one New Jersey mother who's grown increasingly desperate as each day passes with no word from her son. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo has more.
Glassboro resident Jackie Gormley was on the phone with her son Marty Martinez last week when Maria's winds began buffeting Puerto Rico. The cell tower toppled and the line went dead. Gormley hasn't heard from her 25-year-old son since.
I have a lot of faith, but I think the fear is taking over now because it's been 8 days.
Maria was the strongest hurricane to hit the U.S. territory in 80 years. At least 16 people died, and the damage is catastrophic. The storm made landfall just south of Ceiba, where Martinez had been staying with a relative. Gormley tries not to think about whether her son could be injured or trapped in debris or even struggling to breathe. Martinez has asthma and uses a nebulizer, which needs electricity to work. Instead, she finds some comfort in imagining their reunion.
Well, we're big huggers, Marty and I. There will be tears of joy, a lot of thanking God, of course, first and foremost, and definitely hugging him and telling him he can't go on vacation or anywhere without me ever again. That's the truth. I've always told him he has to last me a lifetime because he was the best thing I've ever made.
Until then, she'll continue searching for her son in every way she can imagine. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
While Puerto Rico has suffered the brunt of Hurricane Maria, some visitors to the U.S. Virgin Islands have also been stranded for more than 1 week. WHYY's Annette John Hall spoke to one local mother who's working to get her daughter home.
Hurricane Maria started out as a Category 2 storm. But by the time Temple Theater professor Kamika Williams-Witherspoon reached her daughter on the island of St. Croix, the storm had strengthened to a Category 5.
She called and she said, "Mom, if I don't make it out of here, I just want you to know I love you very much." I said, "Stop it. You're not going to do that." And I started quoting Bible verses. They just sort of upchucked out of me.
Essence Williams is a nurse specializing in midwifery. 2 days before the storm hit, she arrived in St. Croix, where she planned to do her clinicals at the island's hospital. Now she's stuck with limited access to power and water. She relies on strangers' generators to charge her cell phone, which can take up to 2 hours. Plus, her fiancé, Juan Ramos, is diabetic and doesn't have access to his insulin. Williams Witherspoon says it could be weeks before commercial airlines resume their flights on and off the island.
There's so much that I'm nervous about, and we have to have a better way of kind of dealing with these phenomenon, especially when U.S. citizens are involved.
In the meantime, Williams Witherspoon is praying her daughter and future son-in-law will be able to get on a military flight home. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
Amid the continuing budget impasse, Pennsylvania has delayed payments in response to State Treasurer Joe Tursella's decision to not loan money to cover short-term expenses until the budget's done. And the state's bond rating has again been downgraded by Standard & Poor's credit rating agency. Let's consider implications with Richard Edley, president and CEO of Rehabilitation and Community Providers Association. It's a nonprofit in Pennsylvania representing companies providing state-mandated services. Dr. Edley, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me and raising the awareness around this issue.
And it seems like these budget decisions never get decided until deadlines are broached, and the next deadline seems to be October 1st. That's when Governor Wolf says state services could be even more affected. What is at stake between now and then?
Well, at some point, and this happened a couple of years ago, actually, if you eventually reach a point where the treasurer is saying that literally bills will not be paid, it goes back to the budget secretary, Randy Albright, and the governor to begin looking at services and looking at expenditures and making the decisions of what to fund and what not to fund. And when we're talking about the providers, agencies, and hospitals that I represent and RCPA represents, these are some critical safety net services for people with disabilities and really with chronic needs. And this is very, very serious, and it's a looming crisis that people really aren't talking about enough.
What more specifically are you hearing from providers and agencies?
Well, from providers and agencies, I'm starting to get the calls. Because what happened a couple of years ago during the budget impasse, the state did start making decisions and actually at that point began to hold back some of the state-only funds. And by that, I mean there are a number of expenditures like Medicaid, which get a federal match. These are funds that the state pays by themselves to the counties. Well, services like crisis services, early intervention, children and youth, other mental health and drug and alcohol services were cut. And we had providers back then, just a couple of years ago, lose 60%+ of their funding for 6 months and literally were reaching the point of not being able to operate. So you fast forward to today and we hear, wait a minute, as of October, we're going to start potentially making those decisions again. Providers are aware that this could be a real serious problem. What I'm surprised is, why haven't other people been talking about it? A couple of years ago, there were articles in the paper. The legislature was meeting round the clock. There were things on TV. Here, it's just sort of business as usual. And we really have to make people aware that it can't be seen that way.
Well, Dr. Edley, then let me put it right back to you. Why aren't people talking about it?
I think they believe that at the 11th hour, there'll be an agreement. Something will happen. And it typically does. But as in the example of a couple of years ago, it didn't. It was a pretty late solution. And where it compounds itself is that with the same providers today, they already 2 years ago tapped out their lines of credit. They already drained all their reserves. Banks aren't going to come to the rescue. So I'm now hearing from providers saying, I don't have the kind of reserves or capabilities to, well, if it's a couple of months, we can make it. They're down to days. And so when we're talking about services for disabled people in a system that's chronically underfunded to begin with, we're really up against it. And again, I want to make it clear that I'm talking about the services for people with real serious disabilities and serious needs, what we often refer to as the public safety net providers, Medicaid, county-funded, state-funded, and so forth.
Dr. Edley, what role does your association play in both this process and when there is a budget in place?
Well, I think it's really up to us to start being the voice out there. It's really our job to be meeting with the governor's office, to be meeting with legislators, and pushing the agenda and making sure people don't forget. The average person, and quite frankly, sometimes the average legislator might be looking at some interesting ways to balance this budget and not realize, well, wait a minute, by doing that, you just took funding away from 10,000 people, from 5,000 people who are in need.
Dr. Edley, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Richard Edley is president and CEO of Rehabilitation and Community Providers Association. For over a century, the suburb of Cheltenham in Montgomery County, right along the border of Philadelphia, has been at the forefront of racial and ethnic integration. But tensions flared after a fight at the local high school at the end of last school year, and now, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman Arendt reports, the trailblazing community is grappling with big questions.
3 years ago, Malia Brame Scott was browsing a Facebook page for Cheltenham residents when a post from a local parent caught her attention.
She said, "I just want to say, I grew up in a little pocket of Philadelphia called Overbrook when I was a kid."
Brame Scott had also grown up in Overbrook on the western edge of Philadelphia. Back then, it was an integrated neighborhood in transition. White families were moving out. Black families like hers were moving in. The Facebook poster never mentioned race, but she did say this.
"You know, we had beautiful homes built by Italians. I'll never forget her wording. Beautiful homes built by Italians. Kids playing on the streets. And they moved in and we all moved out. And now I feel like I can't even take my kids back to visit where I grew up. And don't let them make you move and sell your homes.
That post went up 3 years ago. Brame Scott still keeps a screenshot of it on her cell phone.
You would think she was describing a war zone. And you would think that the people who moved in were some outsiders who, you know, were just destructive animals.
Brame Scott says it hurts to know her neighbors feel that way. The mother of two moved to Cheltenham 7 years ago, hoping to avoid that exact kind of thinking. Cheltenham had good schools, affordable houses, and a reputation for inclusiveness that dates back 150 years.
Good morning. How you doing?
Earlier this week, I came across Martha Woods sitting on a park bench in the Lamotte section of Cheltenham.
Mind if I ask your age?
You can ask, but I won't tell. I'm a mature lady who's retired.
Woods was sitting on a plot of land that used to be Camp William Penn, the first training ground for African-American Civil War soldiers. This is where Woods' great-grandfather, John O'Brien, prepared for the war.
O-B-R-Y-A-N, that's how he spelled it. Mm-hmm.
120 years later, in 1984, Woods and her husband moved to what has now become an historically black neighborhood.
I live in Lamotte now, and I never realized that this is where Grandpa used to walk, these very streets.
This seems like a crazy coincidence, but there's a historical logic to how Woods ended up here. After the Civil War, the area around Camp William Penn was considered hospitable to African Americans. A small black community sprouted. Then, in the mid-20th century, Catholics and Jews flocked to Cheltenham, partly because of its reputation for tolerance. That same phenomenon is playing out today. But the people striving for upward mobility aren't Jewish or Catholic anymore. They're black families, like Brame Scott's. And even in this seemingly tolerant town, that's causing tension.
People are out there, you know, running around like Henny Penny, the sky is falling, because, oh my God, the black people, the black people.
Rachel Ezekiel Fishbein, who is white and Jewish, moved her family to Cheltenham 18 years ago. Her husband is on the school board.
Well, now I'll be at a party in, say, Upper Dublin, and someone will say, oh, where do you live? Where's your kid go to school? And I'll say, Cheltenham, and they'll look at me. And I play a game with them. They look at me, and they're like, oh, how's that? Or, you still live there? And I'll go, yes, I do. I love it.
But not everybody does. Earlier this decade, the Cheltenham School District became majority black for the first time. And as that shift happened, rumblings emerged that the district had slipped. I dug into the data, and the evidence that Cheltenham's academics have gone down or that violence has gone up dramatically is spotty. But there's a clear perception among people of all races that things have changed. And that perception was amplified earlier this year.
Shocking video shows a fight inside a Montgomery County High School this morning. A teacher.
Last May, a fight among four African American girls inside Cheltenham High School sparked a huge community uproar. Many said Cheltenham was no longer safe. In an area where home prices are already falling, there was concern that even more families would flee.
So this house was built in 1903.
Debbie Carboni lives in a stunning six-bedroom house in the Melrose Park section of Cheltenham, but not for long. She put her house on the market this summer, not specifically because of the fight, but because of disenchantment with the school district.
One of the reasons why we moved here to this township back before our kids were born was actually because it was known to be one of the best school districts.
Now she says the district doesn't have that same reputation, and she believes it's become a less comfortable place for white, conservative families like hers.
Everybody tries to bring the race card into it. Frankly, I could care less if you're yellow with purple polka dots. The reality is everyone should be treated fairly, and this school district does not do that. I have had both my children be called crackers, whiteies, sticks. I've actually had them say that they wish they were dark-skinned so that they could be liked.
She says teachers tolerate bad behavior from black students but punish students like her son, who has ADHD. When she told administrators her son was being called names, she heard this.
We're so sorry. I didn't realize. I can't believe that would happen. You know, we're dealing with so many of the black students who are, and the Hispanic students that are being concerned about being deported. Really? I'm worried about my kid who's getting bullied on the bus.
And it's not just white parents moving. Some middle-class black families are also thinking of getting out. The fear is that Cheltenham, with its long history of welcoming outsiders, will wash away in another wave of middle-class flight. Then there are those who want to stay, like Rachel Ezekiel Fishbein. They hope Cheltenham can draw enough new families who value diversity and are willing to pay high taxes to support a good school district.
We will be the proof that it can work, that you don't have to be a shtetl or a gated community of like people.
But if integration can't work here, in a community with decades of groundwork, the question looms, where can it work? Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
To share your reactions to this story, we invite you to join WHYY and our media partners tomorrow evening for the third installment of our Courageous Conversations series. Tomorrow's discussion will focus on reimagining race and education, how we talk about these issues and resolve them together. For more information, visit whyy.org/events. For nearly 1 year, WHYY has been paying extra attention to people reentering society after time behind bars. We're part of a dozen news outlets in the Reentry Reporting Collaborative. However, few of our stories so far have focused on how it affects kids when mom or dad is in prison. Becky Bertha is an acclaimed children's author from Delaware County, and her newest book is entitled Far Apart, Close in Heart, Being a Family When a Loved One is Incarcerated. She spoke with WHYY News Director Eugene Son.
Becky Bertha, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Could you begin by reading these two pages I've marked early on in the book?
Certainly. When your mom or dad goes to jail, you can have all kinds of feelings. You may have different feelings at the same time, or one big feeling may push all the others away. Lacey feels okay in the daytime when she can play with her friends, but lonely and scared at night when she's by herself in her room.
What made you want to write this book?
I didn't actually start out to write this book. I had written a book of poetry, which I submitted to my publisher, Albert Whitman and Company. And the editor said that they weren't interested in publishing a book of poetry at this time, but she particularly reacted to one poem in the collection. And she wanted me to use that poem as the basis for a picture book. And that was a poem about a boy whose father was in prison.
And how did you get on that topic when you were writing that poem? Was that something you read about, someone you heard about, you know, in friends or family in your daily life?
All of the poems were about children and their relationships with their fathers. And that was sort of the basis of the book. So this was one situation that came to my mind about how a child might be in relationship with his father. It also, of course, grew from a situation in our own family. I think, like many families, we have had a family member in prison.
I took this book home and read it to my sons, and the toughest page for me to read shows a picture of a young boy standing with his arms crossed. He's very upset, and his father is trying to hand him a phone. And then the page says this, if you could read it, please.
Rashid is still too angry to talk on the phone with his mom. Maybe next time she calls, he'll be ready.
Tell me a little bit about why you wanted to include that, where the child is having trouble, doesn't want to talk on the phone.
I think that children have immense feelings, sometimes way bigger than I think adults give them credit for. And I also think that this issue of having a parent who's incarcerated it's not a small issue. It's huge to a child, and it's not an issue that's easily resolved. It's a lifetime issue. It's an issue that affects the family even after the incarcerated parent is out. It affects the family income. I don't think that Rashid is thinking about those things. He just is still mad at his mother, and he's not ready to talk to her.
Lastly, you mentioned that, you know, the part of the impetus, I guess, for the poem and the book is that, you know, that there's some family experience regarding this. I imagine in the course of writing it or bringing it out to the public, you've heard from people who've had that experience, you know, that they have a loved one in their family who has been in prison or in jail. And I'm wondering, do people end up sharing a lot of stories with you in some way or another as a consequence of this book and being out there and presenting it?
Yes, I would say that has been the experience. I'm not going to say almost every family, but I think way more families than we realize have a situation like this in them. And it's not something, people don't talk about it. It's not something that families talk about or share outside of the family. And the book has made it possible for me to learn about that from some families that, you know, people that I would never have imagined had this situation, you know, will say, oh, I need to get a copy of this book because, you know, my brother's cousin's child is in this situation. Or someone said to me, when I grew up, my cousin was in this situation, and it never even occurred to me what he must be going through. And just now, you know, I have an understanding that I didn't have before. So I would say, yes, people do share that with me.
Becky Bertha, thank you so much for sharing this book with us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for inviting me, and I really appreciate the opportunity to let more people know about both the book and the situation of children with incarcerated parents.
That's local children's author Becky Bertha speaking with WHYY News Director Eugene Son. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.